in his life by going into extremely high radioactive areas, doing pioneering work which is going to change the concept of radiation exposure to humans. And as you know, we physicians always test drugs and other things upon animals before we extrapolate and use them on human beings. What is happening to the animals, the insects and the plants is going to happen to us. Only we take a long time to reproduce. Certainly in Sweden, they've shown that babies in utero at the time of Chernobyl have lower than normal IQs because the developing brain is very sensitive to radiation. That's reproduced in Tim's work. Extremely important work.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, convener of the Medical Symposium on the Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Disaster. This is Earthwatch, and I'm Robert Knight, thanking you for your support for WBAI with continuing emergency donations for the WBAI Transmitter Fund at our pledge line at 516-620-3602 or online at give2wbai.org. We also welcome your comments with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's rknight@wbai.org. Now, please stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. I'm Robert Knight for Earthwatch.
Pardon me. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. I am looking for my theme music on the computer here.
It was just there.
It was, oh, you saw it?
Yeah.
You saw it with an H?
Folded.
Howard?
H-O-T something. Hot Wolf.
Hot, yeah, H-O-T-W is what I usually use, but I had it spelled out as Hour of the Wolf.
Whatever folder you were just in, it was there.
Maybe it's under my, it used to be under my documents. Oh, you know what? I bet I've got one on my flash drive that I just plugged in. So, which I just minimized, like the fool that I am, it'll be one of these. Here we are. Kingston.
Oh, that's what
H-O-T-W. Okay, that's it.
I told you it was there.
Yeah. So, one second. Pardon me. Let me warm up. Okay. Earthwatch with Robert Knight was brought to you with portions on recording. Okay. That done. Where are we? This is a very, very tight show because I've got this great interview. And, okay, ah, there we go. I've got this great interview for you, and I've got this, and, well, we have to survive. It's this little, this weird idea that we have, that WBAI must survive, and that is in question. So we're going to have to talk about that a little, okay? So we're going to do both of those this morning. So you just bear with us, and you're going to hear Ken Liu, and you're going to say, okay, it was worth it. It was worth listening to that. But first, let's howl. That's if I brought the right pot up. Huh? Oh, good. It's scanning my file before it plays it. Here we go. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Ken Liu, L-I-U, is the last name, is a remarkable, brilliant science fiction writer, and I recorded an interview with him just a week and some hours ago. You will hear that. Stay tuned. Okay, let me explain the deal. Oh, why not leave the silent running music on in the background? I chose the long mix. We have 90 minutes. I'm here until 3 a.m. And what I have is 70 minutes of recorded material. So, given intro music and outro music and all that, we gotta raise some money. Okay, let me explain. I mentioned this in my pre-recorded show last week. This is not pre-recorded. This is most live. But here's the deal. WBAI, First, we moved out of, with our tail between our legs, we moved out of 120 Wall Street. We're now housed in the basement of CCNY, sharing space with WHCR, who's been a really conducive, nice host to us, nice people around here. And but our facilities are bare bones. I mean, when I started working for the station in 1967 in a brownstone, we had way more space and equipment than we've got now. And that was pretty bare bones already. So this is as meager as WBAI has ever been. But wait, there's more. Or should I say there's less? Aside from the $33,000 or so that we spent on monthly rent, which is now, you know, something to like $5,000, that's only one thing. A fixed cost is the transmitter room. If we don't have a transmitter, we're not broadcasting. It's very simple. And the transmitter is, what is it, Max? About 50 a month?
Yep.
Yeah, it's about 50.
This year, we can go up to 60 next year.
Great. Okay. So, and right now, wait, don't go away. I just need confirmation of the numbers. We had to make, and I believe we have made it in pledges, $50,000 by March 15th.
Yes, that I think we got.
I believe we got it's 85.
It's the other $450,000 that they want by the end of the month. That's
not $450.
Yes, $450.
Wait, $450?
Yes.
By the end of this month?
They're looking for $500,000. Not just for the transmitter.
Oh, okay. The station. Oh, that's payroll and all those minor things.
And making up for the incredibly poor fund drive that we had.
Yeah, yeah. Which, and the poor fund drives, you know, and this is, now, we should have a regular fundraising show called Blood from a Turnip. And, you know, I know that's what we're asking you, the listener, to do, you know, Blood from a Turnip. I know that the solution to making money when fund drives don't work is to hold yet more fund drives. That's somehow, you know, the idea of having more fund drives is counterintuitive. But right now, we have to make this amazing goal. I mean, if we don't make, what is it, $150,000 by March 31st, right?
Yes, but then on April 1st, they want April's $50,000.
That's
so,
right.
So we really need $200,000.
Okay, so
just
we,
for the transmitter.
So just to stay on the air, never mind payroll. You know,
hey, wait a second. I resent that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're actually on staff. I'm unpaid staff. But to make the payroll, to pay the people like Max, that and Sydney who are here, who operate WBAI, to pay for other capital expenses that we have. Max said we need $500,000. I think it's actually somewhere in April that we need the $500,000. I think we only need about $200,000 by April 1st.
Well, but
a mere $200,000.
The last official memo from the boss said that he was trying to get $500,000.
Oh, no, that's understood, that he's trying to get that.
Right.
But the question of whether or not we're on the air as of April Fool's Day.
Yes, that's $200,000.
Is a $200,000.
Beyond what we have now.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And in the past, we could look to the foundation, our owners in California, for a loan, for a payback on the money that we used to give them until the money started going directly to them. And now they're tapped out because we're not the only one of the five stations that have been siphoning off their money. Our Washington station, PFW, has had to move at the same time that we have had to move. And KPFA made a move how long ago? Didn't KPFA, like, buy a building or something?
Oh, that was decades ago, I think.
I don't think so. Well, according
to... They moved the offices, and they may have built the archive, Pacific Archive.
Ah, that could be it. But all I know is that KPFA is also not in... They're spending more than they are taking in, I believe. And my source on this is former WBAI program director and current KPFA station manager, who I spoke to in October, Andrew Phillips. Good eye. And one way or the other, Pacifica is not in good shape. They are tapped out. They cannot give us a farthing. And in fact, the farthings that we raise beyond our immediate crisis above crisis will go into their coffers so that our owners don't disappear. So this is the reason that we must pitch at this time, that we must beg in the same manner. Now, if we survive this, obviously a lot of heads are going to be put together questioning how listener-sponsored radio, true listener-sponsored radio, will continue. If it will continue, will there be some kind of a frequency swap where we vacate 50,000 watts and end up with 5,000 watts and somebody gives us money? I don't know what it's going to be. This is all supposition. I am telling you nothing that I know. I can only tell you what must be. This is dire stuff. This is nasty stuff. And therefore, beyond all logic, beyond all capability of actually hoping to earn money by begging, especially at 1:30 in the morning in Harlem, nevertheless, that is what I am doing. The telephone number to call for the WBAI Transmitter Fund is area code 516-620-3602. We need to raise $200,000 by April 2nd to not go off the air. This is not the usual, oh, WBAI must continue, oh, Pacifica needs you, we're pure and we're this and that. This is survival talk. This show may not be here in a month. And Robert Knight will not be here in a month. And Max Schmid will not be. None of us will be anywhere except maybe on the internet. Maybe. In a month. If we don't make these goals. Okay? 516-620-3602. You can either... That's it. And I don't think this is a call center. We're not even taking the calls ourselves. Something that pains me because I came into WBAI in 1967 as a phone volunteer. Phone volunteers are important, but we don't have those right now. We are outsourcing this. I'm only going to be pitching until 1:45, and then I'm going to start part one of this interview with Ken Liu. Okay, it's in two parts. And yes, you can expect to hear me begging more of the same, when that comes. 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. I have little else to say. That's it. 516-620-3602. You want to hear this kind of a program? You want to hear a program that has been on the air for 41 years, bringing you literary science fiction and fantasy? I'll tell you. You listen to today's show, which, frankly, I'm very proud of, in last week's show with Andre Snyer Magnusson, and then today with one of the few Asian-American science fiction writers ever, period. He and I talk about that. In the first 45 minutes, the first part I'm going to play you all about translations is just utterly fascinating. It's not even necessarily about speculative fiction and all that, although it comes into it. I will rest the quality of the work that I do here at WBAI on just last week and this week. Okay? So why don't I go ahead and play that and just tell you, 516-620-3602. And then see if I can get this, what's the name of this console? I think it's called Verschlungene. No. You see, I clicked on the wrong thing. There we are. Part A. So I'm going to turn that off and call it up because I now know that this is going to scan any file, any WAV file anyway that I click. And I'm not going to tell you a lot about Ken Liu. I'll tell you at the intermission point. But he and I cover that. I will tell you that the Nebula Awards, which are peer awards from the Science Fiction Writers of America, very good, it's done scanning, and I'll restart it in a moment. There's only four categories, all right? There's short story, novelette, novella, and novel. This year, Ken Liu is nominated in three of those four categories because he didn't write a novel, or he probably would have been in the novel category. Last year, in the short story category, he won the Nebula Award from the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. He won the Hugo Award, which is a fan award. He won the World Fantasy Award, which is a juried award. And, well, actually, I think that, you know, the awards that he won for last year, I think we do talk about. So I'm going to shut up, except for one thing, 10 digits. Make it 11, because you have to dial one first. 516-620-3602. Dial it now. And in the meantime, listen to an interview with Ken Liu.
And now we are recording, and I always start by slating things. Today is March 6th, and it's about 3:30 in the afternoon, and we are in the Soho Gallery of Digital Art, the dungeon or basement of the Soho Gallery. And we are me, Jim Freund, and with me, Ken Liu. And this would have been way cool, but after the Nebula nominations, it got way cooler.
It still feels pretty cool.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. Just as aside from, forget awards, especially for short story writers. They are great, they are good. But short story writers are a specific breed. They are obviously doing it for the love, because most short story writers can command, what, $50 a story or something like that.
It's not much.
Yeah, they're not making a living at it. Nobody really is. But now add in the awards. And as far as I know, you may be the only person to win, in essence, the triple or quadruple crown last year in awards.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Yeah. So the short story Paper Menagerie, I'm doing this without looking at notes. Paper Menagerie got one, the Hugo Award, which is a fan award, the Nebula Award, which is a peer award, the World Fantasy Award, which is a judged award, the I Loved It Award from Jim.
I love that one.
IO9 played it up. Were there any other awards for Paper Menagerie?
That is, as far as I know, it. Of course, you know, the love and appreciation from the fans is probably the best award.
Yeah, yeah. And the ability to just get the damn stuff published.
Yes.
And that was, like, cool enough and good enough. But then this year, as of this recording, under 2 weeks ago, the Nebula nominations, that's the peer award from the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, came out. And there are only four categories of a proper Nebula Award. We're not counting the Bradbury Award for script and the Andre Norton for YA. They are novel, novelette, novella, and short story. And Ken didn't write a novel last year, but you're nominated in every other category.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
It really is.
I'm sort of blown away.
Yeah, that I don't think is a first. I think Swanwick.
I'm sure that's been done.
Michael Swanwick. Yeah, whenever I interview Swanwick, well, one time I specifically interviewed Swanwick and said, Michael Swanwick has been nominated for more stories and awards than any other writer in SF history, which is true. To which Michael said, which means I've lost more often than any other writer in history.
The humble man.
But, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Thank you. Yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah, and it has helped that they've changed how stories are nominated and all that, and we're not going to get into what that is, but as of about 3 years ago, I would say the Nebula Awards became more diversified, so it wasn't the same eight guys, and by guys I mean men, being with the exception of Le Guin,
right,
being nominated over and over and over again.
Yeah, that was an issue.
Yeah, and that has really opened up. And in addition to simply being a great writer, if that weren't enough, you are also one of the very few that I can think of Asian writers publishing in science fiction. And I don't know how many I can name. I know Ted Chiang, I've met him at a VidCon. But he was elusive. I didn't get to interview him. There's you. There's Charles Yu.
Yep. Yep.
Who's a really good writer.
Amazing man.
Yeah. Yeah, he really is. I loved his. I haven't read his newest novel, just after his last one.
Yes.
The first.
Yeah.
The first one from about a year and a half ago was just blew me away. It was so much fun. And there's another writer who had, as far as I know, only had a couple of short stories published, but one of them was wonderful. It was actually turned into a new Twilight Zone. That would be the second of the three by George R.R. Martin. It was called something like Blank Blank's Magical Emporium, using the old trope of people going into a shop, that Brigadoon-like shop that isn't always there, in Chinatown in an unnamed city, and finding what they're looking for, even if they didn't know that's what they were looking for in life. Can you name
Asian writers? There's a bunch.
I'm sorry, in English.
Right, there's a bunch of new ones who are coming, just starting to publish, and who are doing really great work. There's Wesley Chu, whose novel is coming out with Angry Robot Books, and Zhang Chu, who just had a great story published at Tor.com. It's amazing, very beautiful.
How's that? CHU. CHU, okay.
Yep. So, there seems to be more science fiction, fantasy writers of Asian descent.
Emerging.
Ali, of course, has been doing amazing work in short fiction. Her stuff is just poetic, lyrical, unbelievable stuff.
Yeah. And it's always wonderful to see these breakthroughs. I was in the same place in about the year 2000 with black writers. And I could only name about six or seven, and that was more than most people could name. And then Cherie Renee Thomas came out with her book Dark Matter, which not only showed a lot of the writers who have been out there, but just unsung, but also opened the field.
Right.
The presence of that book was a breakthrough book. And I think that book alone has started, as in the 70s, we had women finally publishing under their own names without, UK Le Guin.
Sure. Sort of pen name that's hard to identify explicitly as female.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, usually it was two letters last name.
Yep.
And yes, Ursula did actually publish once as UK Le Guin in, of all places, Playboy.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, it had to be.
This one, yeah.
Had to be. And so things are changing, which science fiction is supposed to be about the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be about being inclusive. Of course, there's lots of military SF, there's lots of right-wing SF and libertarian and stuff like that. Well, I like the more progressive.
Well, I think actually you can probably find all kinds of political views in science fiction, and that adds to the fun of it.
Yeah.
It's a debate.
And then talking outside, we're going to get to talking about your writing in just a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to discuss the field and the whole Asian aspect of it, because it's rare that I get to do this. Otherwise, I'm taking listener calls, and it's like nobody out there can call and say, oh, no, I'm doing this, or anything like that. It just hasn't happened. And very important because you're a translator. Asian writers in other languages. And I just remembered the great Japanese writer, Kobo Abe.
Mm-hmm.
I neglected to mention him. And he's one of the great writers of science fiction, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Although not a current one. I believe he's passed on.
I'm not sure. I'll believe you.
Yeah, but people can look it up. His last name is A-B-E, and if you find something of him, read it. But stuff is surely being published, or I hope it's just being published in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And where English is not the first language, which means that it ends up not even being the second, third, or fourth. It's just not getting sold and brought into... well, from our point of view here, it's not just English, but the United States and the
right.
U.S. market.
Right.
You are a translator.
Yep.
Which is a favorite topic of mine.
Really? How come?
I guess it has to do with that all-inclusive kind of thing. It's just that, you know, without a good translator, who would know here of Stanislaw Lem?
Mm.
How would we know of Boris and Arkady Strugatsky? Whose book Roadside Picnic was turned into the movie Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky. And I read that book maybe 30 years ago, but it was very choppy, and I thought, gee, these guys aren't really great writers, are they? And a new translation of that same book came out last summer.
That made a huge difference.
Made
right?
a huge difference. They are now being heralded. In the U.S. and England,
right,
as being masters of prose,
mm-hmm.
which of course they were in
mm-hmm.
their native Russian. So, also I've had on the program several times Michael Kando, although not in a while. He's with the MLA, the Modern Language Association,
yep.
And he's done a lot of translations of lesser known than Lem. Polish writers.
Mm-hmm.
And also when I was a kid, I was reading Judith Merrill's best of books, which were competing with like the Terry Carr books in that era. And she went to the trouble of getting people who read other languages to get short stories in the group.
Mm-hmm.
So by including stuff from other cultures, and after all, we're dealing with a kind of literature that's supposed to deal with the alien,
right,
off planet. But let's deal with alien. He said, wiggling his fingers,
mm-hmm.
on planet,
mm-hmm.
and different cultural points of view. It's why I think that I don't think the question is why am I interested in translations and the quality thereof. Question is, why isn't everybody?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
I mean, what would we do without great people who worked with Borges or Isaac Bashevis the Singer? We're naming some of the great writers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I am. I'm talking all the time. You're not saying much. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm fascinated by the discussion. But.
Yeah. Now, yeah, but I'm just prattling on here, we're here for you. So what is it actually that you translate? What is it that part of your job entails?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I started doing translations not by conscious choice. Basically, my friend Chen Qiufan, who also sometimes goes by the English name Stanley Chan, had a story that he got a translation into English, and he asked me to take a look at it and see what I thought. The translation was...
Is he an English speaker?
He speaks English very well, but, you know, he's not a native speaker. He writes Chinese. And Chen Qiufan is a very prominent young, up-and-coming, actually I would say established by now, science fiction writer in China, one of the most popular of our generation. And he's done a lot of great work. So one of his stories was... He had somebody translating to English, and he wanted me to take a look at the draft. And I agreed, and I just thought the translation was competent, but not really effective. It was technically accurate in a lot of places, but not not well done. It didn't convey what was unique about his voice and what was interesting about his particular way of phrasing things accurately. You might go to a dictionary and say that everything was translated correctly, but it didn't read well. So yeah. I started editing it and sort of giving him suggestions around things that I wanted to change. And the thing is, after a while, I realized that I was really just rewriting the whole thing, and it would be so much easier if I just did the translation myself. So I did it. And
it helps not a small amount that you're a good writer.
I'm going to talk about that. Actually, it's kind of an interesting point. So the story ended up that I translated, it's called The Fish of Lijiang, and it's a science fiction, near future, semi-dystopian tale with a very sarcastic, funny protagonist who has a very strong voice. And that story was sold to Clark's World and ended up winning the Fantasy and Science Fiction Translation Award, which was very pleasing to both Stanley and me.
I'm sorry, who gives that out?
That's given out, I can look it up. It's the world, I think it's called the Science Fiction and Fantasy Translation Foundation.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll have to look them up.
Yeah. It's a beautiful, they do a great job of recognizing translations, because I think oftentimes we don't really pay enough attention to translations, period, like you were saying. And it's great that there's an award established to recognize that. So, anyway, so that's how I got started. And after that, I realized that I'm sort of in an interesting position, because there's a lot of really great, wonderful science fiction and fantasy being written in Chinese, and almost none of it is known to the West, because they're not translating to English. And because they're not translating to English, most readers in the United States and England and other Anglophone countries just don't know about their existence at all, let alone appreciating them. I thought that because I do know these works, and I think I'm somewhat competent at translating, I would make more of an effort to bring more of them into English. So. Since then, I've done a bunch of translations of short fiction by various writers like Xia Jia and Ma Boyong and other Chinese writers who are very well known in China, but not so much here in the West. And the stories I've translated have generally been well received. And so I'm glad to see that my instinct was right, and that great literature gets appreciated everywhere, regardless of the language, and that these barriers of culture and language can be overcome with an effective translation. So now, onto your point about translation. I think translation is a very interesting topic, especially when you're talking about translation of science fiction and fantasy, because a lot of times people feel that science fiction, especially, should be easier to translate in some sense other types of literature, because the idea is...
That's not the assumption I would make, because new concepts...
Well, actually, this is why people make that assumption, because the global language of science is English. So when you're talking about new concepts and new technical terms...
That's funny, the lingua franca?
Yes, exactly. These new concepts and new terms are almost always expressed in English and then borrowed and translated into the various languages that the scientists are speak natively. So the terms that are science fictional, genetic engineering, transgenetic crops, artificial intelligence, that sort of thing, when you go to other languages, you find that their terms for these concepts are basically translations of the English terms. So because English is the global language of science. So the natural assumption is, well, since all these terms are derived from English, then it should be easy to translate back and forth, because they're all sort of, it's sort of like that old joke where you think, when you're a kid, you think that people who speak other languages are not really speaking other languages, they're just speaking English, only with a weird, different accent. And so that's sometimes how people sort of perceive science fiction. But in practice, that's not true. Those technical terms and the technical concepts turn out to be the easiest things to translate when you're going between languages for speculative fiction. What's much harder to get across are the humanistic aspects behind the science fiction. You know, science fiction isn't just about let's come up with a big idea about how to save humanity against some impending disaster or, you know, how to deal with an alien invasion. There's that part of it is interesting for readers, but to me the much more interesting side is how different cultures and different writers who write in different languages deal with the human drama behind these concepts very differently. Because even though science fiction and fantasy are about, you know, imaginative worlds, the very human emotions are drawn from the writer's real experiences, and they're intended for a readership in that language, in that culture, who share certain assumptions. And when you're trying to do translation, you realize how much slippage there is and how much a lot of these things are different between the various cultures and languages, and things that are assumed to be true or that are naturally true for one author and one readership are not true when translating to a different language and for different readers. So it's been actually quite challenging to make this work. And I think a good translator, you know, people sometimes emphasize how a good translator has to have a good understanding of the source language and have really good intimate understanding of the nuances of the source language. And that's true, but I think not enough emphasis is placed on the ability of the translator to express concepts in the target language. So in some sense, I would say that a good translator is not necessarily someone who really, 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 really understands the source language and culture in such detail that he can be considered a scholar, but rather someone who has the necessary skills as a writer in the target language to convey what nuances he can understand in an effective way. It doesn't do any good for somebody who is a scholar of the source culture and the source language if that person is unable to express with subtlety and with grace in the target language, because all that understanding is sort of wasted. So I think people should place more emphasis, or at least equal emphasis, on the ability of the translator to write, because translation really is not about, blindly finding synonyms and putting them down on paper in a different language, but rather recreating one piece of art in a different language, culture, context for a different readership, and to do it in a way that balances fidelity to the source as well as expressiveness and beauty of language in the new work of art. Translation really, a good translator, in my opinion, really should treat his work as an act of creation, and really believe that he or she is trying to create a new piece of art that's based on the original, sort of like a sketch, not a photographic copy.
Yeah. So therefore, it sounds like from what you're saying that it's really a collaboration.
Yes, actually, I would say that the best translations result from a good collaborative working relationship between the translator and the author.
Mm-hmm.
Because surprisingly, there can be a lot of conflict between what the author intended and what the translator thinks will work. Because there are certain, this probably is familiar to a lot of writers. You write a story, and there's some aspect of the story that's very important to you, and then you show it to beta readers, and the readers get a totally different sort of meaning sense out of it than what the writer intended. That actually happened quite a lot between authors and translators. The author...
That actually happens quite a lot between authors and readers.
Right, exactly. That's the part that I think people understand. But between author and translator, there's a similar dynamic. The author intends certain things that are very important, or he thinks are very important to the story, that he thinks are critical to the work of art and created. But when translating to a new context, those may not be the very same aspect that are of interest or important to the target readership. There are certain things that the source audience takes for granted and therefore draws meaning from certain things. But the target readership would have a different set of assumptions and different semantic associations and different emotional responses. And you kind of have to balance that. You know, I'm not advocating that people should take the source and just sort of use it as a blueprint while you write a new story based on it. That's not what I'm advocating. The translator has to be faithful above all to the original art, because, you know, the reader is here to read to get some sense of the original, not to read your interpretation. But in some ways you can't get away from the fact that you will have to do some interpreting, and yet you have to balance between this desire to be faithful to the original vision, and at the same time not make it so alien, so divorced from the target culture in which that it becomes inaccessible. So it's a hard balancing act.
It must be very difficult, because I'm thinking that as a writer yourself, in interpreting this other person's work, all of a sudden people are reading something of another writer, and it's like, ooh, well, there's sort of a trope that Ken Liu has used. And
right, exactly. That's the sort of thing you want to avoid, right? You don't want to be... So I think a translator would be a failure if he or she translates a bunch of stories by different writers, and then the reader reads them and says, they all sound the same.
Well, I mean, it's happened in movies. Steven Spielberg just announced that he's doing another Stanley Kubrick script. He had already done AI.
Yep.
Which Kubrick was developing actually with a couple of science fiction writers, including I think Ian Watson and Brian Aldiss in England,
mm-hmm.
And then he died at age 70, and Spielberg made the movie. And there are parts that are Kubrickian.
Yes, exactly. You feel like there are parts that are very Kubrickian, but ultimately
it's a Spielberg.
Yes, exactly.
And so now Spielberg is doing Kubrick's. I think it's. Is it Napoleon as a miniseries?
I think so, yeah.
And it's going to be Spielberg. My point is that not even Spielberg, and you know, he had this dilemma. I read interviews with him that I thought were very interesting, that he didn't know whether he had to be true to his abilities as a great movie maker, or if he had to try to ape who he considered one of his role models and gods in movie making,
right.
Kubrick. And, you know, nobody can make a Kubrick film but Kubrick. People have tried for decades. They can't do it. And neither could Spielberg. So he ended up doing the Spielberg film. Right. So it must be a very, very difficult line.
Yeah, it's a very difficult line to walk. And in fact, you know, there's also the added layer that I've had a lot of my stories in English translating to Chinese, so I know very well how this feels from the other side. When you're the author and somebody else is doing the translation and you can understand the translation and you sort of see what choices the translator made and you sort of decide whether you agree or don't agree. And the thing is, you know, the first few times it happens, I think as an author, you tend to be extremely protective of your work, at least I was. The first few times I was translated, I was very protective, and I wanted to, you know, the translator would make a decision, and I would agonize over it, and I would be like, okay, is this choice faithful to what I wanted to do? Do I still feel, after this decision has been made, this is still my story, or do I feel it's no longer mine? So I agonize over a lot of these kind of choices, and so I know how it feels from the other side. So when I'm doing the translation, usually because I know the original writers, I'm very respectful of these issues. So if I make a decision that I think is pretty substantive and big, I would try to run it by the author and try to explain why.
If you can, I mean, the problem is that...
Right, not always possible.
Spielberg can't talk to
exactly,
Spielberg.
Exactly. If it is possible, I would try to talk to the author and try to explain why I think a particular decision needs to be made, why this passage needs to be moved or perhaps even removed, and why perhaps we should add a phrase or a sentence here to explain things or to even... change the emphasis a little bit for an Anglophone readership. And but over time, I've come to realize that people sort of focus a lot on this concept of lost in translation, the idea being that there's lots of nuances and meanings in the original that are lost when the translation happens. And that is true. That is true. That's inevitable. It's not possible to translate one work of art in a way that preserves every single nuance of the ocean.
No, it cannot be done.
It's just can't be done. I can give you a very simple example that will illustrate the point. So for example, you know, take the word for God in Chinese, which is Shangdi. By God, I mean the Judeo-Christian concept of God. In the West, when we say God in the capitalized G, that's usually what we mean. In China, the equivalent is Shangdi, which is a term with a very, very complicated history. Shangdi is not a neologism. It's not a new word. It's not invented in Chinese in some recent year. It's an ancient word that existed since, you know, the days of the Oracle script. And it referred to the supreme being of the universe. This formless, not man-shaped kind of supreme being. And later on during Confucianism, it became sort of identified as the source and the basis for legitimacy of imperial rule. So Shangdi literally means supreme emperor. Well, actually, the term emperor is a little problematic because the Chinese...
Well, that's the point. We're talking about idioms here, so you can't say it anymore.
The Chinese term for that's usually translating to English as emperor is not obviously emperor. So the point is, Shangdi had this very long history of a certain meaning. And then the Jesuit priests during the Ming Dynasty, when they went to China, wanted to convert locals into Christianity. And the way they did it was the Jesuits were mainly accommodationists, cultural accommodationists. They believed that to make Christianity effective as a religion in China, you had to sort of adopt Christian concepts to suit cultural practices that are local to China and not impose European ideals onto the Chinese, and which put the Jesuits into a lot of conflict with the Pope back in Rome. But anyway, the point is...
And a lot of missionaries historically would find the local gods wherever they were and turn those gods into the devils.
Right. And
you see, ours is better.
Right. And the Jesuits actually...
You want to use Android, not Apple.
Right, exactly. And the Jesuits are actually very interesting. They took the term Shangdi and said, okay, so we're going to take this approach, which is that the Chinese culture is very ancient and learned, and we're not going to fight them on this point. What we're going to say is that just kind of like, you know, sort of like the old classical philosophers of Greece, they were pagans, but they in their writings and in their philosophy, you could see echoes of later Christian concepts. Mm-hmm. So in some way, the Platonic ideas and these Greek philosophers were really talking about Christian concepts. They just didn't know that Christ was coming. So they took a similar approach to the Chinese classics, and they said that, you know, if you study the Confucian classics very deeply, you will see that there are echoes of later Christian doctrines coming. So it's not that we're teaching you something completely new. We're just trying to teach you to understand your own classics better, to see how they fit into the Christian view. And so they translate, one of the earliest missionaries made the decision to translate God as Shangdi, to identify God with the supreme being that had been existent in Chinese culture forever. And this was a very controversial decision. You know, it caused a lot of controversy back in Rome, a lot of controversy in China.
Yeah.
Like, is this a proper translation? You know, this is sort of, you know, it's fascinating to think about how these translation matters have always been, you know, points of contention throughout history. So, anyway, the point is, eventually, Shangdi did become the term for God. And this imported Western idea that identified the Judeo-Christian God with Chinese Shangdi actually took over and became the dominant meaning.
Yeah.
So the Chinese no longer think of Shangdi in the classical ancient sense of, you know, supreme being of classical ancient Chinese worship, but rather when they speak of Shangdi in modern Chinese, most Chinese would picture the guy with the white robe and the white beard.
Yeah.
Pretty similar to what we think as children
and such is the nature of imperialism wherever it derives from.
Sure. So what I'm getting at is when a story I translated by the Chinese novelist Liu Cixin, he had a story called Shanyang Shangdi, which literally translates as taking care of God, which is what I ended up using as the title. There's a lot of complexities to those layers of meaning, because when a Chinese person reads Shangdi, what he's thinking about is there's this entire history of Western missionaries in China, and the entire history of how Christianity first tried to accommodate to Chinese culture and later became very oppositional to it, and how it became the ideology of the revolutionaries. You know, very important revolutionaries, Hong Xiuquan, Sun Yat-sen, all these people embraced Christianity as a way to change the traditions of China. So, yeah. So when you talk about Shangdi in China, there's a definitive sense, a certain emotional reaction, and a certain kind of association with the word that is just absent when you talk about God to a reader in the United States or England or Australia. You know, we each have slightly different reactions to it, but it's certainly not the same as the Chinese reader's reaction to Shangdi.
Yeah.
So, similarly, Shanyang, the other term in the title, has no exact English equivalent. It refers to a Confucian ideal about the duty of a child to take care of his or her parent in old age.
Wow. Okay.
And you know, we don't really have an English.
So a two-word title,
right,
has two idiomatic issues.
Yeah,
not one.
Exactly. There are many layers,
and they're very important.
They're very important. There are many layers of complexity to this. So a Chinese reader reading Shanyang Shangdi has a definite emotional reaction right away to it that an English reader just won't get. But here's what's important. Lots of stuff is lost in translation in the sense of meanings, emotional reactions, and all these semantic associations that are present for the original readership will not be present in the new readership. But what's important is don't focus only on what's being lost. Let's focus also on what's being gained.
Yes.
There's a lot gained in translation as well. The fact is, you know, when I translated that story over into English, which is, so I'll give you a brief synopsis of the story, and this is a story that you can read online now because it's been published. So taking care of God is about the idea that one day aliens, essentially, came to Earth and claimed that they were actually God, in the sense that they created human beings.
Mm-hmm.
That is, their star-faring civilization long ago came to Earth.
And by the way, hi to Eric Van Dunneken.
So right. Back to
sorry.
They came to Earth a long time ago and engineered the biosphere and manipulated the history to basically create Earth civilization. And now that they've been wandering the stars for millennia, they're old and they're in their dotage and they no longer can take care of themselves. So they came back to Earth and said, you know, you're our children and we created you a long time ago, but now we're old and we no longer have the ability to take care of ourselves. Would you take care of us and let us live with you?
Which is actually very much the way generations tend to work.
Yep.
Parents need their children to take care of them
when
they reach a certain point.
That's right. So the story is you know, about this, how Earthlings react to this news and how they treat these former creators of theirs now that they're no longer powerful and they're in their dotage and they need help. So the story, you know, has a lot of resonance for Chinese audiences because the whole idea of taking care of your aged parents is coming to conflict with a mobile modern society in which, you know, children no longer live with their parents and they pursue careers that take them away from home and so on and so forth, where the extended families breaking down into the nuclear family, etc. So there's a lot of complexity and resonance for a Chinese readership. But in English, it's surprising how effective the story still works. And it works, it's affecting in a different way because the English reader isn't reacting to the same cultural background and the same nuances that were present in the Chinese original, but they're reacting to different emotional echoes and different nuances that are present for us. You know, we have our family relationships in the West that are very different. We have issues about you know, what do we do with people who, as we engage in these end-of-life medical practices that extend their life on and on to the point where the quality of life has, you know, declined greatly. What is our moral responsibility and what is, you know, the right thing to do? And what is our emotional reaction to this sort of problem?
And for the West, which is, you know, has always had this very strong emphasis on individualism and progress, or at least that is the ideological interpretation, which yes. people may dispute. How do you balance that with this obligation towards the past, this duty towards, you know, people who have a claim on the past, on where you came from? For the English reader, it turns out that the story is effective, but not at all in the same way that the Chinese story is effective. It's a different twist, it's a different reaction, and it's a different emphasis. I found it fascinating that essentially the story in English is a different story that is clearly based on the Chinese original, but not the same one. It revealed aspects of the original that were not so obvious in the Chinese original, and sort of brought into open a lot of meanings that I had not thought about. And this whole idea about, you know, how would you deal with a literal interpretation of Judeo-Christianity, the creation myth, that is taking this very science fictional twist? In fact, you know, the story goes down to positive.
It's like the polar opposite of James Morrow.
right.
In which God dies and falls into the ocean and has to be towed away by the Exxon Valdez.
Right. Exxon Valdez. I mean, the story posits that, you know, that humans are not alone, but in fact, these creatures who claim to be God created multiple other planets, and they went to all of them to ask to be created. Mm. And so it's sort of like a Lear story in a way as well.
Yeah.
Which
planets among you love me the best?
Right. And there's this kind of...
It's a fascinating
kind of to see how a translated work fits into a new, different ecosystem of literary references and causes different reactions to the reader.
And the cultural difference is in there.
Right.
It gives the story new life in a way.
Exactly. It gives
the story lost in translation, but here's a new concept added in translation.
Yes. So
but while keeping the purity of the author's concept.
Exactly. And I think people should embrace that. The fact that, you know, you can be a total purist in the sense of, when you're reading a translation, you're not reading the original, so you're not going to experience the same work as the original.
Yeah, I know too many people who say, oh, no, I'm not going to read that book unless I can learn the language.
Right.
People who do just that.
Right. And that's a perfectly respectful view.
And I do watch movies only in their original language, but I do depend on the subtitles. But I want to hear the intonation of the actors.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get both, and very often I will, over time, I will have learned enough French, enough German, enough whatever, to say, wait a minute, that's not what that actor just said, is it?
Right. Wait, that's not what the subtitles really say.
Yeah, right. And it could be that the subtitle, I was watching a Russian science fiction movie, Kinzaza. Wonderful, weird little movie.
I haven't seen it. Okay.
Oh, it's worth seeing. And I had a translation in English, and one of the characters exclaimed something in Russian, and the subtitle said, "Crikey!"
You're like, that can't be really what they said.
And it's like, okay, number one, now we know more about the translator than we did about the movie.
Right.
He's Australian.
Right. And you wonder, what was the original idiom that got translated?
Exactly.
Right.
And that in and of itself was funny. The problem was it also took me out of the movie.
Right.
Also took me out of the story. Thank God it's a light comedy.
Right.
But with sort of Douglas Adams overtones. So it had a very serious aspect underneath it. But therein lies the fun and the problem itself of being taken out of the piece in order to deal with the different iterations it has had. There was a Japanese version of The Borrowers made recently by Ghibli, I can't say it right, Studios.
Studios, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Borrowers became renamed, as it often does, The Secret Life of Arrietty. And there is a British dubbed version and an American dubbed version. They're totally different. Same animation, same story, and God knows what the language of the Japanese version is.
Mm-hmm.
But just watching the English versus the American, hearing the English versus the American voiceovers,
mm-hmm.
Makes me want to see the movie with subtitles.
It's different.
And hear the original actors.
Yeah, that's totally true. So anyway, I think people should try to embrace the fact that a translation is a new work of art, and it will not be a total preservation of the original, but it will be a different work and quite interesting in itself.
Okay, so that was part one of a two-part interview with Ken Liu. And as I said at the top of the interview, and I'll let any of you science fiction experts out there, along with me, go ahead and name five Asian-American science fiction writers. And when I say science fiction, I'm including fantasy and horror. They don't exist. It's, you know, like 20 years ago, I could only name about maybe 10 black writers, okay, within science fiction fantasy. And thanks to Cherie Renee Thomas and her breakthrough book, Dark Matter, now there's even a New York reading series, the Kindred reading series that Jen Brissett puts together, which is just science fiction fantasy readings of people of color. And she has failed to have anything but the best writers in the world at that series alone. So it's really opened up. It's really expanded. It's no longer just, you know, Samuel R. Delaney and Octavia Butler and Stephen Barnes. Very, very limited 20 years ago. I am hoping that science fiction, which is supposed to be the literature of the future, it is supposed to be the all-opening, encompassing literature, inclusive, whereas, in fact, historically, it's been often extremely right-wing or libertarian. When you think of writers like Robert Heinlein or Hubbard or Jerry Pournelle or some of these people, you know, with the exception of Samuel R. Delaney, who I first met at WBAI, not necessarily an open literature where women had to write under, you know, their first two initials, like Ursula K. Le Guin published Historian Playboy as U.K. Le Guin, if you can imagine that, but it's true. That one was out of her hands. Well, but, you know, there are a lot of women who for years and years, and of course all their names now are blanking, because of course I know their real names. C.L. Moore, Catherine Moore, one of the great writers of the 1940s. Lee Brackett, not only a great science fiction writer, but she wrote movies like The Big Sleep, which she co-wrote with William Faulkner, and she wrote half of John Ford's Westerns and Howard Hawks movies, Rio Bravo she wrote, but Lee is an androgynous term, so she got away with it. So there have always been these revolutions in science fiction, and the one for Asian Americans has not really broken through yet. But Ken Liu, who we're listening to right now, has won every award you can win, and deservedly so. And the stuff that he's written that hasn't won awards is worth reading as well. If you go to his website, just Google up Ken Liu, you will read, because a lot of it is online, and Lightspeed, and Clark's World, and free online magazines like that. You can read his incredibly brilliant fiction. And, I mean, you just heard that the first part of that interview, and they're just talking about translations, and the whole thing about the concept of Shangdu, which is not God, but rather, you know, the force of the universe, and how that translates into English and what happens. Some of it is good. I mean, that was just, I was fascinated with everything that person had to say, and I hope you were too, which is why you're going to dial right now. Area code 516-620-3602, and make sure that this show is on next month. Because if enough people don't do it, it won't be. Neither will Burn Baby Burn Clapper with this morning Ahmad Ali coming at you, nor will Robert Knight. Yes, we're discriminating. We're discriminating against the existence of this radio station. We are on the precipice. We must raise $200,000 by April 1st, $150,000 to cover back rent of the transmitter room at the Empire State Building, and then another $50,000 for April, and $50,000 every month. We've already left our digs at 120 Wall Street, which for the space that we had, maybe didn't use well, but we had, was inexpensive. So we've gone from $33,000 a month to $5,000 a month for four rooms in which we can work, and some free managerial space in location unknown in Manhattan. And so we're saving some money there. But in the scheme of things, I don't know what the annual budget of WBAI is. It's got to be over $3 million. Even with these, maybe with these austerity cuts, maybe we're all the way down to like 2.75 or something like that. But here's the bottom line. Before, we were begging for money because for the ongoing goodness of the radio station. That's not the case now. That's not the case now. $200,000 by April 1st, or we're gone. That's it. 516-620-3602. It's half a million. Ahmad Ali says, I heard a number half a million. And it's half a million. That includes, that's minor stuff like payroll.
Get out of this crisis.
Yes, to get out of the crisis, we need half a million all told. But to continue broadcasting right now. You see, the $200,000 is Empire State Building alone. Then there's the payroll. Then there's other back debt and litigation on the money owed to 120 Wall Street and all that stuff. That's what makes up the half mil. But this is right now the question of broadcasting as of April 1st is $200,000. Half a million has to be raised. But right now, if we only raise $200,000, we would be in a horrible, horrible, horrible fix, but we'd still be broadcasting. $200,000 and we're not thrown out of the Empire State Building. That's the difference. Then there's another $300,000. But right now, I am personally pitching not for the ongoing goodness of the radio station, which must happen, but for the sheer existence of WBAI at the Empire State Building so that we have an antenna from which to broadcast. Without that, we're an internet station, at best. And that's not the point of having 50,000 watts in the commercial frequency at 99.5 FM. That's the $200,000 that I'm referring to. The other is merely our continued existence. But the $200,000 is our capability to broadcast. Yes, exactly. Ahmad says it's the difference between dead and dying. So, yeah, that's exactly what it comes down to. Now, we have the second half of this interview to play. And I am going to play it. Oh, that's very interesting. There's actually a phone call coming in. I have no idea how to take it, and we don't have time to take it this week. Next week, I'll take calls. But it's actually showing up on the computer console as unknown phone number calling. Well, thank you, unknown number. Unknown phone number. You may text me. You may... it went away. Jim Freund, or J. Freund, at OurWolf.com. That's to send me an email or write me on Facebook. I'm Jim Freund there. Okay. I am past due here on time. It is already 3:40. So we're now going to hear part two of the interview with Ken Liu. But in the meantime, dial that number, area code 516-620-3602.
worth a show in its own, but we've spent 40 minutes on it.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
The time just flew by.
Yeah. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Ken Liu.
Okay.
How would you describe yourself as a writer? And I don't just mean genre. I mean...
Right.
Thematically, who is Ken Liu?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. I think in some ways I'm still trying to figure that out. Although I suppose in some way all writers are trying to figure that out, at least. I think if you don't try to figure that out if you don't try to learn something new about yourself or try to do something new yourself with every work, and then you're sort of...
And you're still relatively young. Your output is only just young.
I hope I'm still young. So I'm exploring a lot of things. I'm trying to figure out what is the story that matters to me. I've had this philosophy that for some writers, maybe myself included, what they really have in them is one ideal story that they're trying to tell in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
That all of their stories can be seen as echoes of that Platonic ideal story that they have in their heads that they're trying to reach towards. So with every new story they compose, they're trying in various ways to sketch some projection of that ideal story into the world of reality. And that they may never succeed, but whatever stories they write, you can always trace them back to that ideal story in their head that they're trying to tell. And maybe that's what I'm doing, because I think there are...
I think it's fair to say that when I read one of your works, I don't necessarily, circumnavigate and come to this is the theme of that writer. But I do get a sense that if somebody had ripped the cover title off of it, I might have guessed you wrote it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I've had that happen. I mean, I participate in these fiction contests where, it's just a group of writers trying to critique each other's work and submit stories on the theme anonymously, so we can all sort of comment with each other and without the friendships and the reputations getting in the way. And I have heard people say that my stories are very identifiable, even without my name on there. That they can tell it's my story, even though my name is not on there. So there is a sense in which that kind of thematic sort of voice is pretty strong.
I've had interviews with writers where I said, oh, you've got a new book out, come on, let's do a show. And I say, well, it's not science fiction. It's like, yeah, so? it's like, it's still your work,
right?
It's still part of the body of what you have done. And lo and behold, I get to read that work. And even though it's not within the genre, I can tell it's from that writer, and I can tell that it's within that person's body of work.
Right.
And so what's the theme? In your case, it's Ken Liu.
I hope it's not all Ken Liu all the time.
Getting back to, now I don't dare say the Chinese name for God,
Shandi.
Shandi. As somebody might say that, and that's sort of a idiomatic word.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that in this sense, Ken Liu is an idiomatic concept that can be found in different stories. How's that?
Okay. That is probably a little more palatable. I don't know if there's a way to put what I...
I'm sorry, but listeners should see how pleased I am with myself.
Thank you. That was actually very well done. I don't know if I can put into words what my thematic concerns are, but there's a sense in which I'm trying to figure out... science fiction often is described as being very concerned with the future, but I'm not sure my work is very much in that vein. I certainly talk a lot about the future and the meaning of technology and how technology changes concepts that we take for granted and how it changes what it means to be human. But a lot of my stories, I think, have this very deep sort of lingering sense of being concerned with the past in the context of the future. That is, as we're talking about progress, future inventions, and solving our problems of the present day with technology, there's also a sense in which my stories are really very much looking backwards and looking into history and trying to figure out what
does the experience of our parents, our grandparents, and generations before mean in the context of this march towards progress? You know, is this really time's arrow or time's cycle? Is this really a view, a teleological view of the universe, or something more that talks about a recurring pattern, cyclical nature of history? So a lot of my stories are really centered around meditations on these different views of what it means to remember, to embrace the past at the same time that you're moving forward. Because I don't think it's possible to really talk about the future without in some way coming to terms with the past. So a lot of my stories are focused on that, on the passage of the generations, on the way things are passed from generation to generation, on the way meaning changes over time, on the way we can embrace the past while also at the same time critiquing aspects of it and make it meaningful without completely changing it. So in some ways, I guess my work is really about translation too. It's about translating the past for the future, and how to reinterpret and interpret and understand and empathize with the past at the same time that you're moving forward. Yeah. So that's a sort of thematic preoccupation.
Shards of reality, really, is what it comes down to, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a wonderful way of looking at, well, all of it. Whatever it means.
Yeah.
Why don't you read a story for us?
Okay. I brought
along... Do you want to take a break?
I can dive right in. I think I'll be okay.
Okay, great.
Okay, so I brought along a flash piece that I wrote, which I like a lot.
And we should just explain to listeners who don't know, flash means a short story.
A very short story. Yeah. This one is under 1,000 words. It was published in Daily Science Fiction, I believe, last year. And it's one of my favorite pieces.
And again, just to translate for listeners, Daily Science Fiction is a website that publishes a story a day.
Yep, and you can subscribe to it, and it's free.
Yeah.
Okay, so the story is called Memories of My Mother. Age 10. Dad greeted me at the door, nervous. Amy, look who's here. He stepped aside. She looked exactly the way she did in the pictures hung everywhere in our house. Black hair, brown eyes, smooth, pale skin. Yet she also felt like a stranger. I put down my book bag, unsure what to do. She walked over, leaned down, and hugged me. First loosely, and then very tight. She smelled like the hospital. Dad had told me that the doctors had no cure for her sickness. She had only 2 years left to live. You're so big. Her breath felt warm and tickly on my neck, and suddenly I hugged my mother back. Mom brought me presents. A dress that was too small, a set of books that were too old, a model of the rocket ship she rode in. I was on a very long trip, she said. The ship went so fast that time slowed down inside. Felt like only 3 months. Dad had already explained it all to me. This was how she would cheat time, stretch out her 2 years so that she could watch me grow up. But I didn't stop her. I liked listening to her voice. I didn't know what you would like. She was embarrassed by the gifts that surrounded me. Gifts that were meant for another child, the daughter of her mind. What I really wanted was a guitar, but Dad thought I was too young. If I had been older, I might have told her that it was all right, that I loved her gifts anyway. But I was not yet so good at lying. I asked her how long she would stay with us. Instead of answering, she said, "Let's stay up all night, and we'll do everything Dad says you can't do." We went out, and she bought me a guitar. I finally fell asleep at 7 in the morning in her lap. It was a fantastic night. When I woke up, she was gone. Age 17. "Why the hell are you here?" I slammed the door in my mother's face. "Amy," Dad opened the door again. Seeing him next to my mother, still 25, still exactly the same woman from the pictures, I suddenly realized how old he had grown. He was the one who held me when I was scared out of my wits by the blood I found in my panties. He was the one who, red-faced, mumbled to the store clerk to beg her to fit me for a bra. He was the one who stood there and held me while I screamed at him. She has no right to dip back into my life once every 7 years, like some fairy godmother.
Later, she knocked on my bedroom door. I stayed in bed and said nothing. She came in anyway. She had crossed light years to get here, and a plywood door wasn't going to stop her. I liked that she pushed her way in to see me, and I also hated it. It was confusing. "That's an elegant dress," she said. My prom dress was hanging from the back of the door. It was elegant and cost me half my savings, but I had torn it carelessly near the waist. After a while, I turned around and sat up. She was in my chair, sewing. She had cut a guitar-shaped piece from her own silver dress and patched it over the tear in mine. It was perfect. "My mother died when I was a little girl," she said. "I never got to know her, so I decided that I would do something different when I found out." It was strange to hug her. She could have been my older sister. Age 38. Mom and I sat together in the park. Baby Debbie was asleep in the stroller, and Adam was with the other boys by the jungle gym, screaming with joy. "I never got to meet Scott," she said, apologetic. "You weren't dating last time I visited, during grad school." "He was a good man," I almost said. "We just grew apart." It would have been easy. I had been lying for so long to everyone, including myself. But I was tired of lying. He was an ass. It just took me years to admit it. "Love makes us do strange things," she said. Mom was only 26. When I was her age, I had been full of hope, too. Could she really understand my life? She asked me how Dad had died. I told her that he went peacefully, even if it wasn't true. There were more lines on my face than on hers, and I felt that I needed to protect her. "Let's not speak any more of sad things," she said. And I was angry with her for being able to smile, and I was also glad that she was there with me. It was confusing. So we spoke about the baby and watched Adam play until it was dark. Age 80. "Adam?" I asked. "It's hard for me to turn the wheelchair, and everything seems so dim in my eyes. It can't be Adam. He's been really busy with his new baby. Maybe it's Debbie, but Debbie never visits." "It's me," she says, and squats down before me. I squint. She looks still the same, as always. But not exactly the same. The smell of medicine is stronger than ever, and I can feel her hands are shaking. "How long have you been traveling?" I ask. "Since you started." 2 years and counting," she says. "I'm not leaving again. I'm sad to hear this, and yet I'm also happy. It's confusing. Was it worth it? I got to see less of you than most mothers, but also more." She pulls up a chair next to me, and I lean my head on her shoulder. I fall asleep, feeling very young and knowing that she'll be there when I wake up. The end.
Yeah.
That's the story.
That's and it's a good one. It's touching.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Which I would say most of your writing is. First of all, they're entertaining. Second of all, they're very slice of life to mm-hmm. me. I would say that's part of the voice.
Yes,
that you share is a slice of life kind of a voice. But they're also very humane, very touching. They somehow say something.
That's a good word. Humane, I think, is what I like. I go for. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's good. And I really, you know, sometimes I hear a story and it's like, no, a proper interviewer should have 1,000 questions after that. And I think, you know what, I think it spoke for itself. I think it said it and, you know.
Yeah, it's a short story and it does what
it does what it set out.
Yes,
very much so. Why do you write primarily short stories?
I don't, I didn't set out to do so.
Why do you publish? That's a better way.
Okay, here's the real reason, which is that my wife and I have two very young children. And as anybody who has very young children knows, it's just not very easy to concentrate and find chunks of time where you can focus on stuff. For me...
I used to get a lot of lit when I was on it at 5 in the morning. I had a lot of young parents listening just because they had no choice
exactly.
To be awake at that hour.
Exactly.
You know, for me, I've ever since my second daughter was born, I think I've ended up doing lots of flash pieces, way more than I used to. And I think part of that is because that's about the length at which I can operate. So, I didn't set out explicitly to do short stories, but that's the practical answer for why that's the scope of what I do.
Well, this pains me, no doubt, as much as it pains you. Stop grabbing your head, Max. But I have to fade down this interview with Ken Liu because Hour of the Wolf is over for the day, and I have to play the outro in a minute. But here's the deal. Last week's program did not end up on the WBAI archive because the WBAI archive was, to use technical language, for schlunget. So, thank you, Max. So the interview with Andri Snyer Magnusson, this Icelandic writer, is right now. You know, if you didn't hear it, you didn't hear it. And now I was unable to play the entire interview with Ken Liu, which, trust me, is worth hearing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to find a way to put these online. Both of these, and then hopefully you will be able to hear them in their entirety, whether or not you had already heard the broadcast itself. I know also Andri wants to play it for his Icelandic comrades. So, what we need to do at this point is, A, thank you, Ken Liu, for providing such fabulous, wonderful radio and such great fiction. Thank you, listeners who called to donate. Thank you, WBAI, for the moment, being there. But it's not too late right now to call and make a pledge. Area code 516-620-3602, specifically for the WBAI Transmitter Fund. As Ahmad pointed out, there's $500,000 that we have to raise, but right now, just to stay with the transmitter, just to have that, it's $200,000 by the end of the month. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Visit me online at ourwolf.com or on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group, and follow my Twitter feed at Jim Freund, and on ad nauseum. If you're at Lunacon this weekend in Rye Town, New York, I'm going to be recording an episode of Hour of the Wolf there. Hope to see you. In the meantime, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Ahmad Ali. Stay tuned.
Well, you are listening to WBAI.
Well, this is thoroughly fascinating and not only worth a show.
Yes, and Jim's voice is still coming through the computer. And this is Ahmed Ali. And you know something? I'm going to apologize in advance because I ran out of the house and left my bag of reggae. But what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to put on something right now and dedicate it to Tremonti Gray. And that's not it. Got to get used to the new digs here at the new WBAI.
We have about a million or 2 million more of them. If we can get over the summer. Yeah. We'll have to dedicate this one to such a draggy scene that's going on. All the soldiers that are fighting in Chicago and Milwaukee and New York. Oh, yes, and all the soldiers fighting in Vietnam. We'll have to do a thing called machine gun.